The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our forum tonight, Leadership Without Spin. And it's our great privilege to have on our panel tonight Peter Pollock and John Anderson, who I'll properly introduce in just one moment. So just a couple of things about tonight. If you do need to leave to use the facilities, they're out at the back and move to your right. We'll go for about 45, 50 minutes. We'll see how the discussion flows. And I'm really hoping that you feel free to participate in the discussion. So you can do that through one of two ways. You can either, at appropriate times, I'll ask you if you've got a question, just raise your hand. But also, you can SMS to that number on the screen. And magically, your question or comment will come through onto this little device in front of me. Okay, if it all works, that's the plan. So you can do it one of two ways. I'll keep an eye on that, and I'll keep our discussion going. So my name is Peter Caldor, I don't think I remembered to say that, and welcome if this is your first time to any City Bible Forum event. So let me introduce our two panellists, Peter Pollock on the right, and you've got on your sheets I think just a little bit of biographical information about Peter and John. So Peter was the Wisden Cricketer of the Year in 1966, making his debut for South Africa in 1961, and on debut he took 6 wickets against New Zealand. And throughout the 1960s, Peter was the premier fast bowler for South Africa. He played every single test that was on offer between 1962 and 1970. And since then has gone on to have quite a key role in the future of South African cricket once they return from the wilderness. And of course also is the father of Sean, who was a well-known all-rounder and captain of the South African team. And then on my immediate right, John Anderson, former Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the National Party between 1999 and 2005. Entered politics in 1984, was that about right? 1989, representing the seat of Gwydir, and has held ministerial roles for primary industry and energy and transport and regional development. And now, he said he'll be tomorrow back on the farm and driving trucks for his son. Is that right?
That's right.
So a man of many hats.
Probably he doesn't pay.
Are you on that bike? Or you?
I'm supposed to.
Did you hear what his little comment or not? Maybe you need to. Maybe you need to turn your.
Should be on. Can you hear?
Okay. All right, good. Yeah, just sing out if sound is a problem. So can you please welcome Peter and John. Well, when we came up with this title, Leadership Without Spin, we had just suffered an Ashes defeat. We'd just seen a spill in the Liberal Party room. And thinking that we have two men here on the panel who have tasted, you know, the heights of sport and politics in their respective countries, we thought it's only appropriate to think of a topic around the theme of leadership and leadership without spin. But there's just one clarification question we have to get out of the way straight away. So, Peter, have you ever bowled a spin ball in anger?
No, I wondered where you got the spin thing.
Okay.
I was accused of setting the tone for South African cricket when we came back from isolation from 91 through to 2000. And if you read that, it says the concentration was on pace.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, when I saw the spin,
it's without spin. It's without spin.
I know that when I was playing, if the other players wanted to get me a bit fired up, they would say, you know, you seem a bit like a spinner. That would get me fired up. So that's the only thing that has got me going.
Yeah.
But I'll fit in there. I'm used to sort of listening for a while, and I'll see where the spin comes from.
Well, see, hopefully there's not too much spin coming from both of you, but we might get on to that.
Yeah.
Good, well, that's a good clarification, no spin. So leadership without spin. Well, I thought to kick us off, an open question for both of you. Do you think we expect too much from our leaders? I might turn to you. Well, I was going to turn to you, Peter, first, but if you want to kick us off.
You know, anything that happens has a leader. It's been my privilege over my life to lead from junior school, prefect, senior school, left school, cricket, even in the business world, sports. And then for many years I was involved with journalism. When I left school, I got a job. My old man was the editor, so I had the right connection. So I got a job as a journalist, but there was no money. So I later, after I'd given up cricket, I went into the business world and later became CEO of a multi-million company. So I've just seen just a process of leading. And I've never sat down and sort of worked out why. But whatever has happened in my life, whether it's myself or someone else, someone has led. And then at the age of 40, I met the Lord Jesus Christ, and that made a huge impact on my life. I still continued to lead, but what I did understand very, very clearly is that leadership is a gift from God. No question about it.
We'll certainly develop that further as we go on in our discussion.
And as I've watched it, as a fast bowler, when I grew up, from this age I used to bowl faster than anyone. Ball swung, I didn't know why. And I got wickets. By the age of 14 I was playing in first grade cricket with the men. By the time I'm 16 I'm playing for the state. By 19-20 you're playing for the country. By the age of 24 you're the best cricket side in the world. You're getting wickets. And someone comes to you and says, well, what's the secret to your success? And if I'm honest, I don't know. It was just natural. I bowled faster, I swung, I got wickets. And then I started to think to myself, if I've done so well without knowing what I'm doing, can you imagine what's going to happen when I find out what I'm doing? So I started to get very technical. I went into all sorts. I decided not just away swingers, in swingers, slower balls. I appointed myself a coach. I went into the forests and I started chopping trees down and I did all that stuff. And I had a disastrous season. The Aussies came out and fortunately we were winning. So, and my dad was very a good friend of the convener of selectors. So I stayed in the team for the whole series. But at the end of that, I threw it all away and I went back to the simple basics. And I must tell you that all through life, I've found it the same way. I've spent my whole life leading, but I've found more and more, and as I get older and as I grow closer and closer in my relationship with the Lord, I find that it really is. God has written principles into the system. And just to acknowledge those, recognize those, and allow them to be applied to our lives. It's definitely a gifting. In the business world, I was quite shattered by the amount, despite all the technical advances we have in personnel appraisal, we're still putting round holes, square pegs, and that sort of thing.
So, and coming back to the question of expectations, though, in Australia, when we did lose the Ashes, I think there was a sense of almost, don't we have the right to beat the Poms all the time?
No, you don't.
We don't?
No, you don't.
Okay.
But you see, there's always a leader. Why does the leader now suddenly dissemble because he's lost a few matches? Someone's got to lead, and in the game of sport, I think something that we battle with in this day and age is usually the better team wins. Usually the better team wins. And half the teams are losing teams, and
sure.
It doesn't mean that every captain.
I don't know how closely you followed the fortunes of the Australian team, but do you think it had anything to do with sort of the leadership makeup?
You know, I wouldn't go there at all. That's a glib one-liner. When the team loses, fire the coach or the captain. So, and it's never simple. Never.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter where. And that's been my in 75 years as I've lived it out and watched these things. And I've been involved out front, and I've watched it happen. And I know that leadership is a gift. I see a lot of people who have qualified as leaders in their particular spheres and have been hopelessly out of it.
We might turn to the political arena. Thinking about our title, Leadership Without Spin, it almost seems like a bit of an art form for politicians to be able to dodge answering questions. Are politicians actually trained by the media? How to deal with the media? Or does it just come naturally?
Well, your fundamental question is wrong. The basis of your question, or at the basis of your question, is a serious misunderstanding. You see, the great problem we have, and I was thinking about this when Peter's talking about leaders, is that in an age when we don't believe in God, we make all sorts of other people God.
Yeah.
So your core problem is that politicians, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, are human beings. So of course they will spin if somebody tries to entrap them. I met a young person from one of Australia's best journalist school the other day. She said, we are taught that politicians lie and that our job is to get the truth out of them. Mm. I said, well, what if a politician wants to tell you the truth? Oh, no, we're told they never do. Well, that's a hopeless circular argument, isn't it? Mm. But in an age of moral relativism, and the advertising industry tells you what we really value now, our core value, we've turned our traditional belief system and value system on its head. We no longer think that we ought to love our neighbour as ourselves. It's all about you. Look after the most important person in the world, as the bank ad has it. Buy this product. You deserve it. It's all about you. So we're into the age of radical individualism. It's all about me. Do you know when we most see how horrific and ugly that value system is? When we see our leaders practice the very thing that we set up as the core value for our children from the moment they drop on the ground.
So
can you break the cycle? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you can. I didn't come here to be political tonight, but have you noticed how lauded the Premier of the state is for his extraordinary honesty in the last campaign? Mm. He didn't spin. And the people rewarded it. So deep down, we actually know what a real value system is when it's before us. Mm. And I don't think Christians should ever forget that. But so, it starts with humility.
Okay. Do you feel, whether it's, you know, the fault of the media or the fault of politicians or both, this cycle, this vicious cycle you're describing, do you feel that perhaps there is a sense in which we're losing some trust? And just by way of example, I don't know whether we can draw an example from the United States, but there we see the rise of people like Donald Trump or Ben Carson, people who aren't sort of coming from the traditional party room, becoming popular. Is that perhaps a sign that we're not trusting the system?
Yeah, but let me go back to the previous answer I gave you. See, I don't think it's the politicians or the media. I think it's us collectively, all right? It's the social mores we've allowed to develop. It's the idea that we're each an island under ourselves. We're our own little king. Mm. But when we actually see that played out in our leadership, it's not good, is it? It's terrible. It's precisely the same thing as the glib sacking of a captain. Our tin gods failed us. Or even if they're a decent person, we expect them to be God when no human being can be. Is that what I'm driving at? Mm. We're all in this together, I think is the thing I'd want to say. We don't vary. We're the same people. That's at the radical heart of the Christian gospel. We each have dignity. We each have standing. You know, there are no divisions. We are all one in Christ, etc., etc., etc. So I just want to say to you, I genuinely and deeply believe we're all in this together. And the good news out of that is that we can all make a difference. Every one of us. Nation's only the sum total of the individuals that make it up. Every one of us that humbles himself before Christ, that bends the knee, that takes seriously the two great commandments, love your neighbour as yourself, can make a difference, can strike a blow against the cynicism. Of course the trust's breaking down, but it's breaking down because we don't pursue it anymore. We pursue our own self-interest.
So I was going to ask, and you preempted this question in some way, what do you see as some of the major impediments to good leadership? So one of them you're saying is sort of self-interest. What other things do you see as kind of impediments?
I think John's the expert.
Okay.
Peter, I know you well. I hope you're not pumping up my tyres. I once gave a brilliant speech. Even he said it was all right. But then he said, I'm not a flatterer. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, but this isn't my forte.
Sorry, what was the question again?
What? Well, I might push back and come to you again, because I think there are examples you can think of. But I'm thinking, you said sort of an inner sort of selfishness is one impediment to good leadership. You know, for example, what the place of pride? What place does that play?
Let me put it to you this way. The shorthand... Look, a leader is anyone at any time who moves somebody else to do something they wouldn't have done if that person hadn't been there. But a very quick definition of leadership. It's someone who has a vision about where they want things to go, the ability to articulate it to others so they understand it, and the personal qualities to move them to make that vision a reality. Okay? But that, if that's a little template, we need to understand it can be used for good or for ill. Ideologies are unbelievably powerful. Nazism or fascism was unbelievably powerful. Hitler had a vision, he was able to explain it, and horrifically was able to motivate people in the best educated and supposedly most civilised society the world had ever seen at that point in time to work with him to make it a reality. Ideologies are powerful. So what's your starting point? Is it about an evil ideology, about having them serve me, having me deliver for me, or is it... And it's interesting when you put this before kids and you say, what's the opposite example? I used to do this a lot in the parliament. They'd get it. They'd heard it somewhere, the service model of leadership, the Christian one. Your ideology is about serving others. So actually it starts with denial of self. That's my point about we hate selfishness. The very selfishness that we inculcate in ourselves, look after yourself, you can do it, boy, you can do it, girl, you can have a career and this, that and the other. It's all about you. When we see it in our leaders, we don't like it. We actually want them, don't we, to display humility and authenticity and other person-centeredness. Well, I'd suggest to you that's the way we're hotwired.
Peter?
I think too, that one of the impediments, certainly for me, is the belief that we have, obviously motivated by those selling it, the belief that we have is that we can make people and we can make someone into whatever they want to be. I don't believe that for one minute. You can make someone a better leader than he is, but he's not a leader of men. You can watch little kids, and you can see. I think that's one of the gross problems we have with parenting. I need to find out what God has put in my kid, and then I need to be a facilitator to that end, not make him or try and get him to go my route, or because we're cricketers. I was very strong in our family with my kids. I didn't want my kids to necessarily play cricket because Dad did. Yeah. And I never put any pressure until finally, and my wife, I got a lot of pressure from her. Mm-hmm. And she used to say, you know, Peter, you've got it all, you can. And I said, leave him alone. And then we had little Sean, he came up, he's the baby of the family. And when he was 5 years old, I said to my wife, I said, you've always wanted a springbok. There he is. Because you can pick it up. You can see. Those guys, they stick out when they're small. They stick out at kindergarten. And lead us. And that is really what I see the business world today, the church world. And there are so many leaders, people leading, who have no right to be. And that is a huge problem, because the genuine leader, people grow under the genuine leader. He's not threatened or intimidated. This is a natural leader. The unnatural, and you end up with all the pressure in the boardrooms and in his teams. And there's a huge difference between leading, perhaps being head boy at school, and leading a national cricket team, where every one of those guys are five-star talents, and they are strong personalities to have got there. Now you're dealing with a completely... And when I see people writing in newspapers and they're talking about, and they're glibly, what does it take for that guy to have ended up as the captain of his nation at cricket? It's huge. And he's served a huge apprenticeship. And his team can lose. If they're not the best team in the world, they're going to lose.
Sure.
It's as simple as that.
So it's an innate thing, something that we're born with, And I guess the challenge to all of us is to think through, well, what are those innate things that we're born with, and how do we use them for the good of others, as you've suggested. So you've both, in your various careers, had power, be it on the sports field or in business or in politics. How have you managed to use that power for good without being swayed and tempted by that power?
It's scary. The power is scary. Anything of any... It's like you looking at music today. The power of music. Music doesn't need God to be powerful. It's power, the power of money. And I think that is where the great advantage comes to us, because God has ordained it this way. That when you truly come to Him, you don't just go to church and you're religious. You've truly met the Lord Jesus, there's a balance that comes into your life. You start to understand and you start to see the potential of where you can so easily go. I think King Solomon, with all his power and all his knowledge, when he was able to even write a book like the Ecclesiastes, and he had done everything in his life, and he was able to look at it all and say, it's meaningless, it's a chasing after the wind. Because there's never enough power. There's never enough money. You set yourself a goal and you aim. But even before you achieve it, somebody moves the goalpost. And that's you. Why 5 wickets? Why didn't I get 7? Why did I only make 170? I should have made 200. Why didn't I make 10 million? I only made 5. That is what happens with those people. Those are 5 talent people, again, a gifting. And they get in at the top echelon of the world today, whether it's sport or business, you've got them all competing against each other. They all are there. They are self-motivated people.
So we worship leadership. This is one of the great dangers, I think. We worship it. We say it's good. We run courses on school, in our schools and in our business world, how to be a leader. In other words, it's a good thing to be a leader, you must be a leader. Most of the great leaders that I've had much to do with that I really genuinely respect have been extraordinarily wary of power and may not have even wanted it. And I must say I was always very wary of it. Sort of stretching the point a little bit here, but when I was in the running for Deputy Prime Minister, I don't know whether I should reveal this, but the ABC is not present. It probably doesn't matter, tuppence now anyway, that somebody said to me, do you want this job, John? And I said, no, I don't. I'm terrified of it. And he said, good, I'm going to vote for you.
No,
is that the point?
Yes.
So there was a time when John Howard was overseas and you were the acting Prime Minister. In fact, that was during the Twin Towers collapse, wasn't it? 9/11.
Well, it happened quite a bit when he was travelling. He went overseas 13 times, actually.
So 13 times you were actually Prime Minister, but in particular in that moment...
43,
when,
actually.
Right. So
that's proud, isn't it? Sorry.
Okay, who's counting? But
the journalists, I didn't.
Oh, right, yeah. Of course. So, you know, that obviously that there's power there. How did you manage to live with that and see it for good rather than for your own...
aggrandizement? The week of 9/11, you'll all recall that. That was hardly a week when you wanted to be on the bridge. That was really one of those moments when the prayer was, Lord, do I have to be here? And the answer is, yes, you do. God doesn't make mistakes, Peter, as you say. It was also the week that ANZAC failed and there was a refugee crisis. It was a horrific week, and I'd been trying to pull ANZAC back from the brink. It belonged, as you may recall, to Air New Zealand at the time, and they had run it into the ground. I said that once at an enormous church in Melbourne. Somebody yelled out, don't put it that way, you'll offend the New Zealanders. And somebody else called back across these 2,000 people, not going to matter, not as if they're going to go home. Any New Zealanders here? I just lost them. Peter, you better win them. But look, I have been frank about this in the past. When the whole enormity of the whole thing hit me, and for a while we didn't even know whether the Prime Minister was alive, you know, whether he was safe. He was only a mile from where the plane went into the Pentagon. And I remember in the darkest moment of that week getting literally on my hands and knees and saying, well, Lord, I'm here, I wish I wasn't, but you put me here, so my responsibility now is to put all self-interest aside. I remember that was the thing that came to me. And I said, I assume I will be crunched out of this, it'll be the end of my political career, but that's the least of the nation's worries at the moment. So I need all your help, Lord, in helping me find this through so that I'm faithful to you and I deliver for the Australian people. Lest, given that the buck stops with me, because we're all assuming that there are further intended rounds of terrorist attacks. That was the assumption. And I miss something that's coming at me from the intelligence sources, the military people, the police, the whatever, that I shouldn't have missed. It's a terrifying moment.
So
the only thing I wanted to say out of that is extraordinarily, I mean, God met me, I don't mind saying that. But there was a woman in my office who was my political advisor, in other words, the one who could really read people. I won't say she was like Bernard in Yes Minister. Was it Bernard? She was actually a wonderful person, and she read people. That's why she was in that job. And to this day, she says to people who will listen when we talk about our 8 years together in an office, I was in cabinet for just under 10 years. I wasn't deputy PM for all of that time. She said, the whole time I worked for you, that was the most terrifying and unsettling week, and you were at your calmest. And it was actually tied up with me doing what we actually ought to be able to do in leadership all the time, which is put self-interest and self-aggrandizement aside and assume you're just going to get minced. But that's not what it's about.
So it sounds to me like a good antidote to power is a strong dose of humility.
But, humility is not a natural acquisition. It's not something that comes to the human being. The moment you talk about humility, it's disappeared anyway. It's just, that's a fact. And it is not, the most humble person thinks he's arrogant.
Yes.
Right. And it is only a consequence of the Spirit of God in you. Outside that, you can't. It's not marriage. That continuous battle. It only, for us in our lives, it only moved out of our lives. All these issues only came with me coming to grips with the Lordship of Jesus Christ.
So what issues are you referring to?
I'm talking about just, Jenny, it doesn't matter. When you're a strong personality, you can articulate. You can make yourself, you can go into denial, you can do all those things, and you can justify yourself in any state or form you can.
And you found yourself doing that?
Always. I reckon that is the natural consequence of us all. The thing that opened, from the moment, the night I went down to the bottom end of the garden and gave my life to Jesus, I didn't get any warm feelings or hear any bells ringing, but I did something I hadn't done. For 25 years, I sobbed and I cried like a baby. Not just from here, from the pit of me, a combination of joy, release, indescribable, unforgettable. But as I went back into the home that evening, I went her back. It was a dramatic, the whole story was quite a dramatic one. But I went back never to be the same again. But the very first thing that hit me was sin. And not the world's sin, me. The first thing that I was aware of, like the prodigal son, I am the biggest problem that I have. And when I can come to grips with that, then all else can be added unto me, because God has given us skills and he's given us talents. And they work. Whether you're a good guy or a bad guy, not that that's the issue, I'm just saying which side of the fence you're on. And it will be used because... You know, some of the great leaders are very evil, but they work. It works. They have a skill. The great communicators can communicate anything. They're very, very good. We've got a world of talented leaders and talented communicators. The world is full of talented people.
So for you, that was a critical moment.
Absolutely.
When you were 40.
I came to grips with my own weakness and just how vulnerable I was, when I started to understand that really you've got a problem.
Yeah.
The world has built you up. You're listening to all these people. You're the hero of the nation. You've done this and done that and boom, boom, boom. And now, and you believe it all, and now you come to grips with the fact that you're just another one. In fact, you're not just another human being. You've been a bit remodeled by the world's value system.
Can I ask if, thank you, if there are some questions at this point from the floor?
Just wanted to make one, just to summarise that. I read some words the other day from William Wilberforce, and he was the anti-slavery campaigner. And on this issue of humiliation, he wrote to a very good friend, we are cleansed by the blood of Christ, and in that we find a fine humiliation and a wondrous hope. It's the hope we're all looking for. The problem is that we turn it on its head by looking for self. And when we deny self, we can actually find the hope that we're really after.
And you said humiliation, so there's a humbling to get to that point.
That's what he was saying.
Yeah.
Lewis said, our pride prevents us from looking up and seeing God and makes us look down on others, so we don't see them either.
On that note, are there questions at this stage that people would like to ask from the floor? Warren.
Leaders need people to support them. If I can ask Peter a cricket question. One of my memories of your career was in a support role where you were at the other end of Gary Sobers, who had 254 cricket ground in North
Carolina. Were you there?
No, unfortunately not. But
you saw it on that YouTube.
I'd just appreciate some reflections on Sobers, values, and also that tour in the context of being a South African who was there because your country wasn't allowed to have this particular time.
First thing that I say, I can never give back to cricket what it gave. It was an incredible experience to play cricket. In those days, I think they've messed it up a little these days, but that's just an old man who's speaking. But those days and that tour, Gary Sobers, South Africans, out there, it was supposed to be a Springbok tour. It was cancelled and we had the World 11 in its place. And my brother and I were allowed to join the team only for the last three tests. Our union said we had to play our Curry Cup game. So we arrived here the night before the test at Melbourne. We had to go straight on the field almost as we got off our flight. And that was the first time we came up against Dennis Lilly and all that. Now, I had played in many of the World 11s with Gary Sobers. The first time that I met Gary Sobers, it was South Australia in 1963. We toured and we played South Australia. I was fortunate to have a bruised toe, so I didn't play. But Gary Sobers got 150 against us. That is his introduction to us. And we got very, very friendly with them and the West Indian cricketers. Contrary to the world, I mean, South Africans don't go anywhere near black people, but they really were our very, very good friends. And then that test match, because when I came into bat in the second innings, we had a lead of 100. And no, we had a deficit of 100 on the first innings. And when I came into bat, I think we were 270 for 7. And that's 170 on, and we're gone and forgotten. And Sobers and I put on close to 300. I got 54, he got 200 and whatever. And I saw him hit Dennis Lilly out of the attack in two overs. I think it was the third new ball. But, and you know, if you have a look at that, the people that came to watch that game, I mean, it was packed. It was one of the, Sir Donald Bradman watched that game and you can get a tape of it. And he says that's the greatest innings. And for us South Africans, my brother and I, we'd had a great time against the Aussies because we hadn't lost a single series against them in all the time we played. We got here, we were one down, we won that third test, fourth test rained out, and then we won the fifth test too. And at the end of the fifth test, I had the privilege with Tony Gregg and my brother to have dinner, to be invited in Adelaide to dinner with Sir Donald and Lady Bradman. And we had dinner with them, and around about 11 o'clock it was time for us to go home. And I don't know how it happened, but someone got onto the body line and he took us and he showed us all his films. 4 o'clock in the morning we got home. And we only had to make 70 or something to win. And when I got to the ground, I thought to myself, there's isolation, there's everything. What else? What else do I want? And I retired that morning. I announced, to the surprise of my wife, South Africa, and everyone there, the Adelaide Oval, I said, I'm finished. I'm not going to play another test match. I'd had it a lot. Sir Donald Bradman was absolutely fantastic to us. He was always a great friend of South Africa. He felt that the cricketers didn't deserve the consequences that were dished out of them. Yes, apartheid was an iniquity, but why did the cricketers, why did that side? And he was a very good, almost like a father to us. So there's a long story, and with all that, I can never give back to cricket what it gave me, but it taught me all those things. At the very highest level. It was the best cricket team in the world by miles. And we played, we had a lot of great cricketers in there, and you saw these things. And let me tell you, when you see skilled people, the skills, I didn't know it then, but they come from God. God is sovereign God. He is, and he dishes out the talents. Some are given five, others are given one. But God is, he is absolutely meticulous. He's in charge of everything. And it's not about religion or the church and the things we've made it. It's about an awesome, and in my life, all I know, in my 75 years, having had all that success, I got to meet an awesome, awesome God. And to me, that is the sum total of everything.
Peter, who owns the gifts? Can I ask one from here? Who owns those gifts, the talents?
Yeah, well, God is the giver of them, but when he gives you a gift, you own it. He's given it to you. He never takes it back. You know, the Bible says the gifts and ministries are without repentance. So you can take your gift. You can even be evil. But your gift is without repentance, and you can use it. Hopefully, you will take your gift and use it to his glory. Because he made this world. He ordained. I mean, God could. Holy Spirit in everything. But he decided, no, he decided to use men and women. He decided to take his glory and operate through men and women. And we have to realize that. We really have to realize that and allow him to finish your gifting.
I have a question here, and there may be another one from the floor. As a leader, what do you do when you've made a wrong decision?
Say sorry.
Say sorry?
Oh, no.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. You know, I must tell you that one of the greatest things in time, the longer you live as a preacher, and I've been preaching some 35 years now, and I do a lot of reading and all that stuff, but and I read avidly, and I spend a lot of time on my knees, but the longer I live, the more I realize how little I do know. And, you know, I have no problem whatsoever. If someone comes to me and says, and asks me a biblical question that doesn't have an answer, I say, I don't have a clue. I don't know.
So, humility again, being willing to admit that you're
wrong.
Well,
I don't like the mention of the word humility, because, as I said, it disappears.
As soon as you mention it. Okay. Okay. Other questions from the floor?
I'll just make one very brief observation there. Watching a lot of politicians over the years, when they're in trouble, I actually think sometimes that's when self-obsession, which is the flip side of pride, that's when they really get into spin trying to deny the undeniable. And in that sense, pride really can come before a terrible fall. It's better just to come clean and say, I'm sorry, I got it wrong.
Yes.
Very interesting to hear you talk about aspects of humility and some of the personal qualities of the individual in relation to leadership. charisma to think about. You know, someone can be a great orator, etc., etc. And I guess my question is, can someone who has a substance, that's just useful, but without the sky, be a leader? And have you seen successful leaders who are, you know, great substance, but without being highly charismatic, without being the sort of, without having the sort of style that
I'll just repeat it for the sake of this recording. So, can you be a great leader if you have the substance to be a leader, but you don't necessarily have the charisma and style that might normally go along with leadership?
You might think.
Yeah.
I think too associated with that same question is for you, but in that same question is because the system has got so ingrained in marketing and all that, all the buzz, that is it possible to actually have any sort of impact without actually having to go there? I add that. Is there an option? Can you actually, in the way all the razzmatazz of the modern politics, when you watch Trump and all that, is it possible? Or has the system made it impossible for that leader to come through?
I hesitate to say that it's impossible, but I share your fear that it's, and it will certainly become much more difficult. Two enormously influential men who turned their societies and indeed the world on its head were undeniably William Wilberforce and Abraham Lincoln. Neither of them would have gone within a bull's roar of winning a pre-selection and an election today. One was a short and very sickly little man, albeit with great speaking ability. The other was so tall and gangly and mishappen and sort of undressed and, well, not undressed, but badly dressed. He wouldn't have made it either in an age of spin and marketing. But the other problem we have is this incredible intellectual and moral poverty, really, of the public debate today. So you can't get a core consensus on key values anymore. You can't get it. In an age of moral relativism, this is another one, I'm stealing one of Peter's observations here, you only have to be able to breathe oxygen and you have to be listened to. Now, I don't want to be patronising here and say that people shouldn't be heard. That's not my thesis at all. It's not my belief. But it is very much the case now, and you'll see it all the time in the media, and I see it in farming. You'll have people who actually really understand it, really understand it, and ought to be listened to, and have the evidence upon which you should make decisions, confronted by somebody who's running purely on emotion. And I'll tell you something, the bloke who puts up the emotion today, the emotional tug, is more likely to win than the one who knows the facts and the evidence. And I think that makes the problem worse. And so if you were to ask me, you haven't, but if you were to ask me what I think the biggest threat confronting the Western world at the moment is, apart from the fact that as a Christian I plainly believe we're inviting upon ourselves an absolute calamity by mocking God and scrubbing him out of the public square, I'd say the related issue, frankly, is that we're utterly unable to have a civilised, cogent, intelligent debate and agree that we'll make decisions having heard the evidence, having heard everybody's input, and then find reasonable compromises out of it. That is not the way a modern debate works. Voltaire, who was no friend of Christianity's and an absolute lefty, would have been horrified by the way we do it today because, that thing attributed to him, it wasn't him, but, you know, I may disagree with you, but I defend to the death your right to say it. That's not the way we operate today. Reasonable people everywhere in this country feel that if I put my view on the table, that won't, the idea won't be the issue. I will be. I'll be ridiculed. I'll be minced. I'll be belittled. I'll be mocked. So I'll just stay quiet. And some of our premier media institutions and premier media players, I'm sorry to say, in this country are absolute masters at it. And I don't know how they sleep with themselves at night.
Sounds like we're getting on to another topic. No, that's good. We might come back to that one. So I did see a hand raised over here, though. Nick?
Yeah. So you mentioned natural thing, some guys have it, some guys don't, and you mentioned it coming when God puts you there. As someone who was put there, what would you have to say to people who haven't been given it, or maybe have been given?
What would I say to somebody who hasn't been given leadership ability?
That's the first part.
That's the first one. Go and sing hymns louder in church on Sunday. In grateful appreciation that you're not asked to put your neck out. Because leadership, real leadership, I'll be really frank about this, it is tough, it is painful, it is often thankless, and in our society brings with it massive misunderstanding. Now, having said that, I don't want to discourage you if you feel called to leadership. I really don't. I said that to a young man a little while ago, and he came back to me 2 weeks ago and he said, no, I still want to have a go. Today he's in the federal parliament. His name's Andrew Hastie, member for Canning. But the second part of the question, Nick, was...
What if you have leadership?
If you have those abilities, you want to make a difference?
And you haven't necessarily been given the opportunity.
Can I just say, and it's a vital, vital point, is that leadership, the gifting of leadership, if you take someone like Moses, there is, and something that we don't want to acknowledge, there is an apprenticeship. There's no question. An apprenticeship involves two very important issues like patience, persistence, and being able to do those things, because you might well be a potential leader at the age of 24, but God has set you up to do the job when you're 38, and you've got to serve an apprenticeship. I think that that is another thing, because sometimes you'll find that because the human factor, the guy who has a skill, like when God said to Ezekiel, he said to the prophet, he said, go out there and speak my truth. But I have primed you for the job. I've given you a certain personality. I've given you a flint for it. I built you for that job. I feel the same thing applies to leadership. If God has given you a gift, he's given you the wherewithal. But we have to understand that there are processes. That's why it's so important to have mentors, to have your Pauls and people like that, because we have to recognize that, and there's no question about it. You need a mentor. We need mentors to help build that thing up, and don't pluck green fruit. Give the leadership, because part of leadership is to experience. You don't learn about life, I promise you, in the books. Life is about an experience. It's about road travel.
I think I entirely agree with everything Peter said. And mentoring, I mean, I was mentored. And one of my mentors was a Member of Parliament who then sort of said, I want you to have a go at this. And some of the most wonderful moments of my life of when young people have sort of said, look, would you mentor me? I've actually had that happen to me quite... I'm sure you have too. They've actually deliberately and intentionally said, would you play mentor to me? And they have been some of the most privileged times of my life, and still are. So that's... I'd encourage you. I'm sure, Nick, there are people, you know, who have or would mentor you. And the other thing I'd say is, if you want to make a difference, that's honourable. Okay? That's entirely honourable. I hope you all want to make a difference. In that sense, I don't want to sound as though I'm negative about leadership, despite my flippant comments earlier. Go looking for the opportunities to make a difference. You know, you go into it with your eyes open. It can be tough at times. Even sporting leadership in this day and age can be very tough. But please don't let me leave you with the thought that I think it's dishonourable to want to do that. I think just the opposite. But what a great idea, and how valuable it's come out. So you girls are much better at it than we blokes. You support one another, you talk, you open up. We blokes don't. And young fellas especially, no matter how good their relationship with their dad might have been, particularly if it hasn't been so strong, the opportunity to have fellas draw alongside you, especially older men with some experience and so forth, it makes the world go round. And I would want to encourage you, at the same time as I say, be wary of leadership, understand how dangerous it can be, and how tough it can be. I would certainly want to encourage you, please be people who want to make a difference. You want to have a go. There's two wonderful men here from the Solomons, and they're in church leadership. It's lovely to have you here. It's just terrific. And you come from a troubled country, and you're making a difference. And I'm sure that leadership's sometimes tough, but we're really glad you're there.
Can I just pick up on that? And you made the comment earlier about leadership comes through the life lived and travelled. rather than through books. So the point that
you can't take it categorically.
No, but what I wanted to ask you, Peter, is the question...
It's relative.
How much is through difficult times, through suffering that you might have experienced in South Africa...
I'll answer that now, but I just want to say too that with the leader knows that he knows. He knows that he's going to. And he has a vision. You can't necessarily share it with anyone, they might think. But guys who are leadership qualities, they do believe in themselves. They are self-motivators. There's no question about it. I know when my brother and I, you get in cricket, for instance. There were the people that used to go and play cricket in South Africa whose dream was to play for South Africa and get their cap. And they get their cap, hallelujah, you know, I've made the grade. My brother and our dream, the cap was the start. Our dream was to be the best cricket side in the world. Now, that is what makes the difference. It's where your vision is. Is that the ultimate of where you want to go? And I want to tell you that the things we learnt the tough way, it really, when you look in the Bible and you see and you start to, and it doesn't mean we want to go and have a persecution complex because God isn't in that at all. But we have to understand because I only learned the tough way. I had a wonderful father, I loved him to bits, and he had a lot of very good sort of encouragement and wisdom, but I still had to do it my way. I still, and I believe that that's it, because that's the biblical. When God chose people to come, they had to serve out. We don't like it today. We think that when you are successful, you just walk, whether you're in the church, you just walk through everything.
So John, can I just turn that to John? You've said you learned through the hard way. In what way has that shaped you learning through the hard way? Have there been difficult things you'd be prepared to talk about that have shaped you as a person and as a leader?
Oh, well, we're all a product of our environment. Yeah, my upbringing was... I too had a father who loved me and who provided well for me, but we were hit by, time and time again, by family tragedies, and they were massively shaping for me, and they were ultimately, in many ways, to make me grow up before my time and start asking big questions about what I believed and why. So it brought me to faith. And then, when I look back, I can see that one of the things God was preparing me for was to understand how, if you like, there are a lot of people out there who hadn't had my opportunities educationally and so forth, who actually were as skilled or as capable as me and could have been brain surgeons if they'd had what I'd had. So I can see, you know, God using a lot of circumstances to train me up. I'd just say, and I don't think Peter would mind me making this observation, when he said you've got to believe in yourself, I think you mean in the Pauline sense, of a sober assessment, and then being driven by your passion to make a difference, not a sort of full-headed, I'm the right person to... No. That's just
it's,
that distinction.
It's when you get a setback. You believe in yourself to overcome that. You don't get easily dissuaded.
The funny thing is, just to finish that point there, I'm sure John Howard wouldn't mind me saying this, because he said it publicly. He had many, many, many political setbacks. And he persistently and doggedly, never giving up the bone, kept going. Now, I had a lot of setbacks and had to keep going through them, but they weren't political for me, funnily enough. Mm. I didn't lose votes, funnily enough. I don't know why. I'm sure I would if I put my head up again now. But that thing about keeping going, you know, the shortest address ever given was Churchill, when he was asked to speak at one of Britain's best schools after the Second World War, and the headmaster prattled on a bit too long, so Churchill just sort of shambled over to the dais, looked around the room for assembled boys for a couple of minutes, and just growled, "Never give up. Never give up. Never give up," and sat down.
Short speech. We've just about run out of time, gentlemen, and audience. Sorry, not getting to that question. Maybe you can catch them after. So we've really only just got 1 or 2 minutes, but I just want to ask one last question of each of you. You've both mentioned, in your case when you were 40, in your case, I'm not sure, you didn't say a year, but in your formative years, that a significant turning point was you've expressed it differently, but you know, placing your trust in God, in Jesus. So what is it about And relating it to the topic of leadership, what is it about Jesus and about his, if we can say this, leadership style or his style? Presumably you see no spin in Jesus. Like, what is it that draws you to him? What's attractive about him? So just a short answer, if I can, from each of you, and then we'll just wrap up.
I never saw a style or anything. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He's the awesome Son of God. And when that hit me, my life would never be the same. I didn't look at him as a style or a... Or a
but you might now have read more and...
No, he's still out there. I know what you're saying when you say, well, we study the life of Jesus. I dare to say Jesus was a bit different to the rest of us.
Yeah.
By a long, long way. And I think that's important. To me, one of the greatest issues of my life and my whole relationship was the awesomeness of that night that I sat in front of the TV set. And I saw my whole world came before me, my whole life. And I realized about the awesomeness of God. Never to be the same. And I know sometimes in the early days when I was a preacher, I used to sit there and I had my Bible and I had a Bible study thing. And one morning I really felt, I looked up and I said, Lord, you know, I'm busy analyzing you. You must be joking. Who am I to analyze God? And I closed my book and I said, never again. Never again. And I understand when we look at these things. And all that it reveals is that the great revelation is, as we study the Bible, is to see that God has put into the system a whole lot of absolute principles. And they are in there and they work. And don't go against them. Don't make decisions against them, because sooner or later you are going to reap the consequences, because God has ordained that.
Okay. And John, for you, what is it that, what's so special about?
The only Jesus. Explanation that makes sense of a conundrum of life, because in Christ we find perfect mercy and perfect justice. And I cannot see how you can ever have love without justice. There must be justice if there's to be love. Love is meaningless if there's no justice. Because when we see a Hitler put 12 million people through the gas chambers, if there's no justice, there's no love. You see what I'm saying? On the other hand, if there's justice, I desperately, desperately, desperately want to avoid it. And I'm promised that in the blood of Christ, the justice I deserved is taken away. I deeply and profoundly can believe no other. No other. And when I look at human beings, and I'm a person who genuinely loves people. I was in public life because I love people. Well, I find it unbelievably hard being hated by other people because I love people. And I'm always amazed when I look at another human being, when I hear their story. But I'm always dismayed when I see the problem of sin. So for me, Jesus is perfect justice and perfect mercy. And thank God for the mercy, because I don't deserve it.
Amen.
Well, on that note, I might ask you to thank our two panellists.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.